Hello and welcome to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com, a show exploring the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. I'm Louis Moroni, and for this week's show, we will be listening to a panel discussion from the Marxism 2013 Conference to Change the World, which was held at Ryerson University from May 31st to June 2nd, 2013. The conference was organized by the International Socialists, an organization of activists committed to helping in the construction of such a party through ongoing activity in the mass organizations of the working class and in the daily struggles of workers and the oppressed. My ATC partner Jim Vernon recorded the following panel discussion titled From Orange Wave to Third Way, the NDP under Mulcair.
The surprising victory by the NDP in the 2011 federal election, making them the official opposition for the first time in their history, generated both hope and apprehension on the left. And with the passing of Jack Layton soon after, and the taking control by Thomas Mulcair, it's safe to say apprehension took over hope. This panel, representing both longtime NDP activists, representatives of their longtime working class base, and those working largely outside of electoral politics, explores the lessons of the Orange Wave and considers in the light of it the validity of social democratic movements for change in an age where movements like Occupy and Idle No More are building external avenues for solidarity and class revolt.
Quebec City. Nora was editor-in-chief of the Ryerson Free Press and communications and government relations coordinator for the Canadian Federation of Students Ontario. Nora was recently elected to the national executive of the Quebec-based Eco-Socialist Network and is a member of her local coordinating committee for Quebec Solidaire. She blogs at noraloretto.ca. Our second speaker is Katie Arnup. She is a feminist, NDP activist, and a member of the IS. And our third speaker is Rich Wyman, who is a labor activist and a leading member of the International Socialists. So, Nora.
Thank you, everyone, and thank you so much to the organizers for bringing me here. I have a complicated relationship with the NDP, and anyone that reads my blog might know this. I write quite a bit about my frustrations with the NDP, and I struggle with being constructive. I often feel the urge to suggest lighting things on fire, which is not constructive and is not a political solution to anything. And so in preparing for this speech, I did something that I never do. I wrote it. I wrote my speech, so it's going to be probably a little less funny because a lot of my comedy happens on the fly, like a stand-up comic, and so I apologize in advance for that. But the good news is that if you missed something that everyone did laugh at, you can go and check what I said at my blog because the speech will be there. I also just want to start by acknowledging that we are on the traditional territory of Mississaugas, the New Credit First Nation. And also want to recognize the incredible struggle that students at this university that I was part of went through to be able to operate this building. lawsuits and meetings and 4 years of action on the ground and action in meeting rooms got us this. And I'm so, so proud to be able to stand here. And it's still as awesome as ever. So, actually, I'll move this down a little. As a populist party that has seemingly abandoned its base in the drive for liberal and even conservative supporters, it's hard to imagine the NDP fulfilling the roles that most activists or progressives believe it should fulfill. I was never an activist for the NDP, but I learned a lot working from the outside of the party through the Canadian Federation of Students Ontario, where we hoped our policies would be adopted to become policies of the provincial party. Because, as the left-wing party that is meant to amplify the demands of social movements, we believed that that was the role they held. In addition to their own policy-making structures, the NDP should be taking its lead from the activists on the ground and in those social movements. Those groups are the groups with the research. Those groups, or us, had the expertise. But of course, both provincially and federally, this rarely happens. Instead, social movements, including the labor movement, have to operate more like lobby organizations, even if the majority of their leadership are members of the party. In these interactions, it's clear that the NDP has broken the drug dealer's cardinal rule. It has gotten high on its own supply. Yes, the federal and both federally and provincially, it has forgotten that it's not actually the Liberal or Conservative parties, and that it must fight its brand of politics out on a different terrain. This omission will prove to be the party's most critical error. Like a game of chess played against a chess master, where you move every one of your pieces in a mirror image of their moves, you will do well enough until eventually you lose. When I moved to Quebec City, possibly the only city in Canada where I had zero political contacts, my partner and I literally stumbled across the office of Quebec Solidaire at the start of the Quebec election last August. The language barrier had made me more shy than I had ever been in my whole life. But luckily, I was half drunk and walked into that office, my partner walking into a window, and we became involved immediately. Now, Quebec Solidaire is new. As I wasn't around for the glory days of the CCF, it's hard to compare the two parties as they're at different stages of their existences, although Rich is going to talk a lot about that. But my involvement in QS has made a few things extremely obvious. First, that for a party to be able to call itself progressive and not get laughed at, it needs to be rooted in social movements. This remains a struggle for QS, as much of our political organizing starts with the question of who are the groups leading the charge and how can we help them? Second, keeping any party firmly on the left takes a core group of people who will unwaveringly challenge the party and its members to reject electoralism, even when a motion comes forward with the laudable goal of increasing the number of seats in the next election to 5, which recently happened at our National Congress in May. Third, and on the left, this is sometimes ignored or not held up as being important, the leadership of QS, that is the spokespeople, are charismatic, intelligent, and popular. Both the former leader and the current leaders have histories in community organizing that helped to produce impressive faces for our party. So impressive that one of our spokespeople was voted the most popular politician in 2011 of all Quebecers, among all Quebecers, and the other was voted the most popular in 2012. I could talk more about QS. I could also go on with identifying all the problems that I see with the NDP and its provincial wings, national party as well, but I only have 15 minutes, and I think what's important here is to have a discussion of what's possible, what's desirable, and what is to be done with the NDP. To start, socialists need to ask ourselves, is the NDP even capable of shifting far enough to the left to be able to undertake the changes that we believe are necessary to manage, not even stop, the ravaging effects of capitalism? If the answer to this question is yes, then activists must look toward working through the party and its apparatus to try and force change from the inside. I have no doubt that the current strategic direction, the drift to the right, and the abandonment of the party's core issues to offer Geico-stolen promises off car insurance are the result of collective organizing capacity of the folks currently within the party. Change the people, it's undoubtedly possible to change some of the politics. And if we agree that the current democratic model is itself the problem, then we might be satisfied with making such minor changes while we push for more radical changes from outside the party. Indeed, I have many, many friends who've chosen to take this direction. However, I can't ignore the conservatizing influence that this has on activists. While what I've just stated is true, that moderate change is likely possible with the regime change of the players, it is also more true that in the relationship between who changes, the party will undoubtedly change less than the person being involved. To pretend this isn't the case is total naivete. While I know that some people are comfortable with this trade-off, it's important to be honest that it is a trade-off, and in my opinion, just isn't worth the time and effort that has to be put in. So this leaves us with the only other answer to my question. No, it is not possible for the NDP to shift enough to the left to undertake the changes that we believe are necessary to manage the ravaging effects of capitalism. Unfortunately, in a government role, the NDP has proven that this answer is the most likely one to be correct. The NDP has never delivered what it claims to be able to deliver. Instead, NDP governments have broadly inflicted neoliberal policies while offering some modest social reforms in some cases. This reality means that the option that will likely have the greatest impact for socialists is to abandon the NDP altogether and coordinate a process of broad and fundamental regroupment. If we believe that socialists should be fighting it out in mainstream politics, then regroupment is our only hope. And whether this takes the form of a new political party or just a provincial or federal network that's main job is to force change on the NDP from the outside is determined by several realities that we must collectively face. First, regroupment cannot be reorganization. It must include groups who've not normally worked together, organize on new terms, and around the core of what we believe the NDP should be fighting for. Regroupment also has to include labor. Despite the problems that exist within the labor movement, unions are still comprised of people and offer Canadians the best vehicle to broadly organize. Labor activists must make links with social movements and find ways to advance their politics within their communities and externally. This means that the labor bureaucracy, the ones who have decided that the NDP should be elected at all costs, has to be challenged. It is not good enough to simply want to keep out HUDAC or kick out Wall. People need to be organized around issues, not against people. Finally, and obviously, regroupment needs to be focused on a core set of demands that will once again inspire people to be involved with politics. Maybe this should start with demanding a corruption inquiry at the federal level, radical but entirely possible education and health reforms at the provincial levels, and transportation and energy alternatives. If we cannot expect the NDP to lead on these issues, activists themselves must build networks centered on these values and force the party into action. Or, if action on the behalf of the NDP is impossible, we need to lay the groundwork to start a new political party. QS is remarkable for many reasons. But it's most important for activists outside of Quebec because it shows what is possible. We only have two deputies, and with only two members at the National Assembly, Quebec Solidaire has been able to respond almost daily to the debates that are happening at the National Assembly. And not just respond, but actually offer criticism and alternatives. They drew on the strength of the student movement and ensured that the discussion about free education wasn't relegated just to student demands, but in fact the desires of progressive Quebecers who were both inspired and who stood in solidarity with the student strikers. The only way to test the NDP is to provide strong parallel movements that can challenge the austerity policies of the federal and provincial governments. If our movements are strong enough, broad-based, and not limited to our regions, we can actually put the NDP to a test, and I would argue, hopefully, a final test. Either the party will join our movements, take its lead from our demands, and advance our demands, or they'll pull a Parti Québécois, get elected on a left-to-center platform made possible by the activist work undertaken in the province, and then betray Quebecers by backing down on nearly every promise. It will be at that moment that the next steps become clear. Either they're with social movements, or they're not. And if they're not, the organizing that has been done up until that point will form the perfect basis for a new party. Thank you.
We just heard Nora Loretto's contribution to the Marxism 2013 conference panel discussion called From Orange Wave to Third Way, the NDP under Mulcair. Nora blogs at noraloretto.ca, and the International Socialist can be found at socialist.ca. You're listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegion.com. You can find us at afterthecollapse.net. And now here's Phil Oakes with Love Me, I'm a Liberal.
In every American community, you have varying shades of political opinion. One of the shadiest of these is the liberals. An outspoken group on many subjects. 10 degrees to the left of center in good times. 10 degrees to the right of center if it affects them personally. So here then is a lesson in safe logic.
I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Get it? I go to civil rights rallies, and I put down the old D.A.R. D.A.R., that's the Dykes of the American Revolution. I love Harry and Sidney and Sammy. I hope every colored boy becomes a star. But don't talk about revolution. That's going a little bit too far. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Humphrey was chosen, my faith in the system restored. And I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter, don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bus my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Yes, I read New Republic and Nation. I've learned to take every view. You know, I've memorized Lerner and Golden. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. But when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. I vote for the Democratic Party. They want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. And I'll send all the money you ask for, but don't ask me to come on along. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Sure, once I was young and impulsive, I wore every conceivable pin. Even went to socialist meetings, learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser, and that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal.
Welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegion.com. We are at AfterTheCollapse.net, and that was Phil Oakes with Love Me, I'm a Liberal. And we're going to return to the panel discussion from the Marxism 2013 conference of the International Socialists called From Orange Wave to Third Way, the NDP under Mulcair. Here's Katie Arnup, longtime NDP activists and, for reasons she'll make clear, recent conscript to the International Socialists.
All right, well, that's a little bit of a tough act to follow. So as our lovely chair mentioned, I am, full disclosure at this point, still a member of the New Democratic Party. I am a member of my federal riding association executive, as I have a lot of respect for my MP, Olivia Chow, and the other members of my riding association. That said, we continue to have a lot of really difficult discussions at our riding association, And I can assure you that not a single member of my executive campaigned for Mulcair in his leadership campaign. And I'm also a recent member of IS, and I will touch upon that a little bit later as to how that sort of came about. I grew up in a family, just because I know I don't know a lot of you and you might not know who I am. I grew up in a family of trade unionists and feminists and activists. One of my moms, Sue, let me cast her vote from a very, very young age. She would bring me into the voting booth and hand over the pencil, and it was her opinion that enough education had happened to me and I could make that decision. So I remember that most times I cast a vote for the NDP, except for when very close friends were candidates for the Communist Party. One such example was a dear friend of the family, the late Marvin Glass, who we lost just a week or so ago. Marvin, who I will miss dearly, was instrumental in building a solidarity network with Cuba, and I was incredibly lucky to have the opportunity to meet with Cuban delegates almost every summer at our cottage, discussing international movements of solidarity, politics and social movements, and you know, what was possible here in Canada. I am not here necessarily to provide answers or a clear direction moving forward, because I myself continue to be conflicted and unsure about next steps. I would just like to discuss some of the ways that I think that the NDP has changed recently, and some of the examples of the party's responses to social movements in recent days, to sort of build on the insights that Nora has just given us, and some of the questions she's posed about the capacity of this party, and whether it is possible from inside or outside to shift it far enough in the left, or for it to stand for what we think it originally stood for. I have many friends who have worked or still work for the Federal Party. They are part of the machine in Ottawa. And in the past 2 years, after the unprecedented victory and expansion of the party in 2011, things have changed a lot. Many of my friends have chosen to leave their positions, or some are just unsure of where their next step will be. From an organizational standpoint, it's easy to imagine how this happened. Suddenly, hundreds of new staff needed to be hired. People who applied for these positions weren't necessarily staunch party loyalists or even socialists, but often people who saw the NDP as the new Liberal Party or the new party moving to power. In this period of time, we also lost our leader. That meant that for the next year or so, while the party was undergoing a leadership campaign, don't get me started on the lackluster list of candidates, the party was restructuring, being organized from within, and it became a much more bureaucratic, top-down organization than it had ever been before. Not that the atmosphere on the Hill was ever perfect, but my friends say that it has become a climate of machismo, male dominance, and a bro culture of ego and power. And so when this happens, what gets left behind? What gets forgotten? What is no longer a priority in this climate within the party? Social justice, feminism, having a feminist voice at all. It moved into becoming an insular top-down structure. At the federal level, the current reality is that we basically have two Liberal parties. This is not only devastating to the leftist movements, who have pushed for a progressive party to be at the forefront, who grew the party to be what it was, but it also significantly increases the power of this united right conservative regime. So I guess the questions that we're here to ask or to discuss are, you know, how do we move forward and what is the evidence about the party, both federal and provincial, current responses to movements at each level? You know, the question is it in building grassroots movements outside the party that have become too large to ignore that we can pose change? What has happened in recent years or months when our party has been handed social movements to them on a silver platter? And sort of two examples that stick out to me. One is the huge mobilization of childcare advocates in BC. They mobilized a hugely successful campaign that resulted in having both the Liberals and NDP in BC have to change their policy multiple times because they had to respond to this outpouring of support for a broad-reaching policy option. They put the parties also into a position where they were immediately coming up short because they provided a full new idea, a rethinking of how childcare worked in BC. And all the parties could really do was say, okay, well, we'll give you this piece of it, or we'll give you a small a part of it. And it was really handing policy to the NDP on a silver platter, in my opinion. And yet we can see, when the campaign was successful, achieving thousands of endorsements and broad public appeal, the NDP was still resistant to take it on. They upped their commitment to reduce fees, but they maintained that such a radical shift would have to be a second term type idea, or that it was just not possible in the current economic climate. With thousands of people saying this was what they wanted, hitting the news every single day, they weren't willing to take a step forward. The second is Idle No More and Chief Teresa Spence's hunger strike, which for me was a huge turning point in my support for the NDP. While I in no way felt that we were perfect on relations with our First Nations, I was stunned by the complete lack of action and in the end hurtful action that the party's leadership chose to take. Even looking at things from a perspective of cynicism and political strategy, it made absolutely no sense to me. Chief Spence was taking a hugely brave and personal stand against Harper's regime. This set the stage for a much broader movement challenging our colonial past, our destruction of the environment, and complete failure to provide a decent standard of living for all. Similar to the aforementioned BC childcare campaign, this was a gift for the NDP. At least 20 of the members of the caucus, some of them whom I continue to hold in high regard, were outspoken about their support for Spence and the growing movement, and visited her during her hunger strike. And yet that wasn't the party's position, or that of the leader. I nearly fell off my chair when I heard that Thomas Mulcair announced, following in Harper's footsteps, that he urged Spence to end her hunger strike. I read countless of amazing responses from sisters across the country about how this paternalistic act undermined the deeply personal practice of fasting in Indigenous traditions. For the record, it was very shortly after this that I joined the IS. And so, you know, just to put that into real perspective, Justin Trudeau, chose to visit her. I don't claim to be a genius in political strategy, but if Justin Trudeau is making better political decisions than you or appearing more progressive, you're doing it wrong. And with that, I would like to hand it over to Rich.
You just heard Katie Arnup's contribution to the Marxism 2013 conference panel discussion hosted by the International Socialists, called From Orange Wave to Third Way, the NDP under Mulcair. The International Socialists can be found at socialist.ca. You're listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegion.com. You can find us at afterthecollapse.net. And now here's The Stars and Stripes of Corruption by the Dead Kennedys.
Bottom. The symbols of a heritage and a power. quietly in the night. Somehow fixed to see the homeless people pass out of the lawn. So this is where it happens, the power games and the prize of loving for a piece of ass. The stars and stripes of corruption.
Welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. We are at afterthecollapse.net, and that was the Dead Kennedys with The Stars and Stripes of Corruption. And we're going to return to the panel discussion from the Marxism 2013 conference of the International Socialists called From Orange Wave to Third Way, the NDP under Mulcair. Here's labor activist and leading member of the International Socialists, Rich Wyman, on, among other things, the enduring value of the NDP.
Thanks, both Nora and Katie. I think this is a really important discussion because it was only last year's Marxism event we were all sort of taking a step back and reeling from the orange wave that had sort of rolled across the country and trying to analyze what does this mean, because obviously it was an outgrowth, I would argue, of the mood that, you know, Occupy sort of represented, a mood of anger at the economic crisis, at the deterioration of working people's lives, at all of these things, that people were hungry for some form of alternative, and in, you know, the democracy, so-called democracy that we live in, parliamentary elections come to play a role of allowing people at least one little moment, 15 seconds in a little booth, to express their opinion about how things should happen. And I think that was my analysis, and I think many other people on the left's analysis, of why there was an orange wave. Obviously, Thomas Mulcair had a very different opinion of the orange wave, which was, I'm just assuming this is what he thinks, is that if only the party had moved further to the right in that election, they might have just actually beaten Harper. And so it's strange to be in less than a year or a year and a half that have had such a moment of excitement already now be crashing down in a wave of demoralization when your party is the opposition, which in, you know, parliamentary sort of politics allows you to just say whatever you like, attack the, you know, party in power, and it's Stephen Harper with buddies like Mike Duffy and Rob Ford running the show. This is not a hard government to be taking on. And yet the only moment of excitement was when Mulcair apparently gave, you know, Stephen Harper a good tongue-lashing the other day in Parliament. I watched it. It was a rather perfunctory, boring little thing and nothing at all that I, you know, would have suspected one would be able to do. But nonetheless, that is where I think things are. And so we have to ask ourselves, what has happened? Is this new? And I would argue it's not new. If we look at what just happened in BC, where, you know, the NDP beautifully snatched defeat from the jaws of victory by allowing the Liberals to walk in because they had no platform that would address the crisis inside people's lives right now and the crisis in the society we live in. They would say the Liberals were bad, but they wouldn't say, as someone pointed out, we're going to cancel the pipelines and instead embark on a massive retrofit by employing thousands of plumbers and pipe fitters and training people, and we're going to do all of these and create jobs and be damned to the market. We're going to actually try to transform people's lives. Instead, it was the Liberals have done a lot of bad things, and, well, we're not really going to change any of that. That was the NDP's campaign, and if the party of that's supposed to be an ally of the poor and working people basically says we won't reverse, we don't even have the courage to reverse the attacks that the Liberals have engaged in, well, then maybe the Liberals were right. Maybe workers and the poor are the problem. That's a, you know, a conclusion I think a lot of people might be able to draw. If we look at Ontario, where the NDP had a sparkling moment, a very simple, mild little proposal, how about we have a tax on the incredibly wealthy? Overnight, Andrea Horvath became the most popular politician in Ontario. They haven't said hardly anything about that since. Instead of recognizing that there was a deep mood of class anger at the 1%, at the filthy rich who profit off of everything we do. In Ontario, there was a real mood depth of anger. What did the NDP do? They made a deal with the Liberals, they got a little tax implemented, and then they walked away from any discussion of class struggle, and in the process, actually tried to jettison most of the unions at the same time. If we look at Nova Scotia, where the NDP's been in power, and there's people from Nova Scotia here, simple little things like maybe changing the Labor Relations Act to make it a little easier to join in, no, couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. Couldn't even replace Tory appointees at the Labor Board. Okay, every government comes in, you get rid of the old party's bureaucrats. Nope, couldn't do that. That would be unfair, they said. Attacked schools, attacked teachers, attacked education. They made some gains in healthcare, but if you read it carefully on all the promotions on this, doing well with the money that they've allotted to healthcare. Nova Scotia healthcare is ranked number one. Doing well with the money they've allotted, not that there was a massive infusion of new money, so on and so forth. Now people on the left in Nova Scotia have to face a real debate about what do you do in the upcoming election and what does that mean. And I think that this is a debate that's going to be going on all over the place, because what does it mean? You know, and if we look at what just happened at the recent convention of the NDP, the ditching of socialism, you think what a distance from the days of the Regina Manifesto, when the NDP would compete with the Communist Party to get busloads of people out to support strikers at, you know, in Oshawa, Ford's in Oakville, or sorry, Ford's in Windsor, when that was the mood of the party. The mood wasn't by the leadership to run from strikes and run from struggle and hide from teachers demonstrating. It was to actually go and to try to build. Where you had a manifesto that said it is about working people capturing the wealth that they create and building an equitable society, basically by overthrowing capitalism. I disagree with the method they chose to do that, and I think you can see the result of that method, which is a parliamentary method. And so the question is this new? The betrayals in Nova Scotia, the betrayal, you know, the debacles in Ontario at the federal level, in BC, is this new? Is this something fundamentally different? Is it really a shift from Mulcair, you know, from Orange Wave to Third Way, or is it just Third Way back to the Third Way again? And I would argue that that's what it is, that there isn't a big shift under Mulcair. I think it can feel that way as an NDP activist, but I think when you take a step back and look at the practice of the NDP in power, and it's not just the NDP, I'm not saying this to harp on about that, but all social democratic parties around the world have fallen into the same trap. And this trap is to see Parliament as the location of change. And so if Parliament, or you know, whatever, I can't, what's it called in Ontario? What's Queen's Park, there we go, sorry. It's important, but I obviously don't pay enough attention to it. You know, if change comes through Parliament and change comes through, you know, every 4 years, people going to polls and electing, then the goal has to be to win that election. If you can transform capitalism by passing an act, by saying, you know, tomorrow there shall be no capitalism, then obviously the goal of every socialist should be to win an election, to get as many seats as you can, because we will be able to stand up one day and say, by ruling order number 32, the new parliament in Canada says, bosses are abolished. Hooray, we're done, everybody can go home. Unfortunately, capitalism doesn't operate that way, and neither does parliament. Parliament is an institution of the ruling class, was created to justify class rule. And while we have to defend our democratic rights to vote, as many people did when we fought against the prorogation of parliament, it is not an institution of changing capitalism or getting rid of it. And I think that that's something we have to come to terms with. That if you see Parliament as the place of change, then the object is, don't worry about your principles, just get seats, right? And that is what the NDP has generally done over the last while. So, its object is to tame capitalism, not get rid of it. That is what I would argue about the NDP. That it claims to be arguing we have to do what is real and be realistic. That seems to be the new line. So my question, is it realistic, as someone pointed out, for people in Sarnia and the First Nations to die of cancer? Is it realistic that First Nations in BC have to watch their land get ripped up for pipelines to be built? Is it realistic that we can't have decent health care in Canada? Is it realistic that there has to be welfare cuts? This is what, when people say we have to be realistic, they're talking about. They're saying we have to be realistic by allowing Stephen Harper to savage and cut and enrich the 1%, well, the 99% just has to sit tight and wait until the next election. Because remember, when we get enough seats, that's when we'll really change things. And I know we didn't do it in Ontario with Bob Rae, and I know we didn't do it in BC under Glenn Clark and the others, and I know we haven't done it in Nova Scotia, but this time we really will. That is the constant mantra. And it's not that people in the NDP don't want that change. And this is what I would argue. How much time do I have left? Because I could go for like an hour here, so somebody better. Pardon?
10 minutes?
Oh, good. I got lots of time. Talk slowly. So the question is, what does that mean for the left? And I think that there's different responses to this. One is to say, be damned to the NDP, we don't care about them, let's just, you know, ignore the NDP and denounce everybody who's got anything to do with the NDP as being a capitalist or one of the enemies. The other strategy, I think, is to say we have to recapture the NDP to some glorious moment that existed, and I would support that if it was about the NDP retaking over the Regina Manifesto with some tweaks. But those are the two sort of strategies that sort of get put forward. And for the first one, the one that says, hey, just ignore the NDP, don't worry about it, we'll just find a better way, I would say that misunderstands why people look to the NDP, because the NDP isn't an insignificant thing. It's a big political party. Many of us, if you go to a demonstration, you go to picket line, people might no longer be carrying NDP banners, but I can guarantee you lots of those people, if they don't have NDP membership cards in their pocket right now, come the election, they're out actually trying to win, you know, trying to help a candidate, and every activist that's built a movement knows that. The minute an election's called, there tends to be a giant, albeit it's not as big as it used to be, but a giant sucking sound on activists you know leaving the movements to go and campaign for somebody in the NDP. So it's obvious. So why do people look to the NDP? It's not because it's become the Third Way or ditched socialism. The NDP hasn't changed its nature fundamentally. It still represents, I would argue, for thousands and thousands and thousands of activists and people who want to fight and want to see change, it represents their aspirations for a better world. And because of that, we have to take everybody who has aspirations for a better world seriously and engage with them and talk to them. Secondly, the NDP represents, albeit I would argue in a deformed way, the recognition by thousands of working people and activists, the necessity for our own independent political organization. Although this organization, as the NDP is constituted, is oriented on parliament, it is a basic recognition that the Liberals and the Tories are bosses' parties. Okay, they are parties to represent the ruling class, and the 99% needs its own political expression in parliamentary politics and in politics as a whole. And for that, I think it's an incredibly important thing. Because look at the problems that happen in the United States. Right? For all my attacks on social democratic parties, it represents an advance in working people's understanding that we need our own political party. I might disagree with the orientation of that party on parliament, but it is a recognition of that, and it's an important recognition, I think. Which means that I would still go vote for the NDP, regardless of everything I've said and will continue to say about the NDP, but I don't vote for it because of its platform. Good God, of course not. I vote for it to be side by side thousands of working people, poor people, activists, who are desperate for some sort of change, any sort of change, and most of them now walk to the polls with some sort of knowledge they will be betrayed and let down by the NDP. But also, if and when the NDP wins, after that orange wave swept through Quebec, lots of people went into work and looked at their boss who had, you know, Conservative Party buttons or Liberal Party, and it was a little smile, we're coming to get you next, right? And that confidence that it can give momentarily is also another important reason why I would still vote for the NDP, because it represents those aspirations and that sort of hope. However, the problem still is, what do we do? Do we be in the NDP? Do we be out of the NDP? What do we do? To me, it's a tactical question. But right now, my argument would be is that to spend your time inside the NDP arguing for Resolution Y or Resolution X is a bit of a mug's game. The party policy book is quite wonderful. If you read through it, there's all kinds of great policies, policies against pipelines, policies for disarmament, policies for conversion, policies for all kinds of things. But the way the party is structured, because it's a parliamentary party, who runs the party? The people that have seats in parliament run the party, not the membership. The membership don't have, they can pass all the resolutions they like, but there is no real democracy inside the NDP. So to me, to try to push for change internally is not the place where energy should be spent. If we look at some of the great things the NDP has done recently, it was one of the only social democratic parties in the world that came out against the war on Iraq, if you think about that. No other social democratic party in the world did that, which I think is something that they should be lauded for. But the question is, how did that come about? Did that come about just because people passed resolutions, or did it come about because there was a mass movement built on the streets that was not built at the start by the NDP? It was built by activists in the NDP, but it was built on the streets, outside in the communities, in the neighborhoods, in the workplaces, and that movement forced the NDP to the left momentarily, right? And so to me, the question becomes, where is it best to spend our time? Now, you know, I'll go vote. It's 2 minutes of my life, pretty much over the whole span of my life. But I think we should spend our time trying to find a way to recreate and rebuild a political alternative for working people to look to that isn't based on winning seats in parliament, but sees parliamentary elections as a tool to amplify voices about building movements on the shop floor and in the streets. And to me, that's the most important difference between something like Quebec Solidaire and the NDP, is that from everything I've read about Quebec Solidaire, its parliamentary deputies don't just see themselves as playing little games and, you know, parliamentary, you know, whatever, chicanery and these, you know, whatever they do there, all those silly games and stuff like that. They see themselves as amplifying and trying to put forward alternatives for people outside of parliament, not trying to convince the politician across the floor, but actually trying to amplify the voice of the streets inside parliament and use that profile to actually try to build movements. And to me, that's an important difference. And so the question becomes, how do we build that? And that's a question I think a lot of us are going to be discussing. But in the meantime, I will say this, one of the things I think everybody on the left has to really think about is, I would argue, and Katie, you were alluding to this, is that there is a decomposition at the base of the NDP right now, where there are more labor activists that I know that are wandering around demoralized and homeless and trying to figure out, what is it that I do next? You know, the class isn't resisting as much as it should be in terms of inside the unions, but the NDP has walked away from thousands of activists and riding associations and other places through the mechanisms that, you know, and things that Katie has outlined. So the question is, how do we relate to those people and how do we give them hope and what kind of alternative do we provide for them? And to me, the International Socialist is a very small sliver of an attempt to actually do that. And that's why I'm a member of the International Socialist, because I think it looks to saying we want to be side by side everybody in the NDP while we're fighting for justice, but we're arguing we don't think that that change will come through Parliament. We believe that, as Karl Marx said, the emancipation of the working class has to be the act of the working class itself, not its parliamentary deputies. And that's why we need a revolutionary organization to continually push on that and say that there is a possibility for change. Occupy, I Don't Know More, these things are fantastic examples that change isn't going to come from Parliament, but change is going to come from us, and that's what we in the International Socialist stand for. And that's where I think, if you got a choice between being in the NDP or being a revolutionary socialist, I'd say park yourself with the revolutionary socialists.
You just heard Rich Wyman's contribution to the Marxism 2013 conference panel discussion hosted by the International Socialists, called From Orange Wave to Third Way, the NDP under Mulcair. The International Socialists can be found at socialist.ca. You're listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegion.com. You can find more about us at afterthecollapse.net. And now, here's Union Town by The Night Watchman.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. Today the policeman's a union man, brother firefighter's my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. That's why, my friend, the blood tastes good every time I'm here. I got a will to win and a Cheshire grin. Yeah, the night watchman is near. And you can't get it where you're at, but you can sure get it here. So come rain or sleet or dark a night, come wind or frigid snow, there's 100,000 in the streets, and that number's gonna grow. And when we put the governor on trial, I'll be in the front row. Just take a look around, we're a union town. 1, 2, 3, 4, let's go. This is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. Oh.
That was Union Town by the Night Watchman. Thanks for listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. You've been listening to a panel discussion called From Orange Wave to Third Way, the NDP under Mulcair. presented at the Marxism 2013 conference at Ryerson University, which ran from May 31st to June 2nd, 2013. You can find out more about the conference and the other speakers that were presented there at Marxism2013.com. And learn more about the International Socialists also at socialist.ca. Find out more about our show and this episode by going to www.afterthecollapse.net. I'm Louis Moroni.
And I'm Jim Vernon.
Thanks
for listening.